Greetings and regenerations from the disaster capital of the world, my fine listeners, and welcome to this November 2012 Science News Update. I'm your host for this dread-inducing science podcast, Jim Campanella. Seriously, I'm pretty sick of being in Disaster Central for the last month, and I'm not so sure I look forward to the next month with its greater predictions of dire doom. For those of you in parts too far away to care or have heard, we here in New Jersey, USA, were terrorized by Hurricane Sandy, which ripped through this state, as well as the New York City area, like Gerard Depardieu at a smorgasbord. In short, devastation was left in its wake. Floods, down power lines, no gasoline, houses, cars, and people crushed under trees, and worst of all, Netflix is taking up to a week to get movies out to us through an almost stopped mail system. The horror. That was 2 weeks ago, and still many people I know are without power, and still my wife and thousands more cannot get into New York City for work using the train system because it is as dead as Romney's chances of becoming president. Huge trees still litter the area in places they should not be, and anyone with a house on the Atlantic shore considers themselves lucky if their house didn't just get washed out to sea. Oh, and we had a small earthquake here last week as well. Ah, yes, and a major snowstorm. At this point, I am wondering whether I shouldn't move somewhere relatively safe, like Iraq. We are now preparing ourselves for the plague of locusts. By the way, in case you didn't know, my science podcast is due up at the end of December. That's after the 21st, which is supposedly the Mayan end of the world. I was pretty skeptical, but if it keeps up around here the way it's been, I may just barricade myself in on December 20th. Enough kvetching. Let's talk about science. First up, one of our fine listeners, Conrad Berube, sorry for the pronunciation, Conrad, if it's way, way off. Conrad was kind enough to email me with a correction about one of our October stories. You may remember that I discussed the construction of a time-space crystal clock last month, and one of the complaints and or questions that I had was whether it would be able to keep time after the heat death of the universe. My assumption was that the heat death of the universe would be the equivalent of absolute zero. Hence, no moving particles and no functioning time-space crystal clock. Well, Conrad pointed out to me that the definition of heat death of the universe is not absolute zero. It may be near absolute zero when it happens, but it simply means a homogeneous temperature throughout the universe with no hot spots left anywhere. If that's right, then the temp may be just high enough at the end there to allow that clock to be running for a couple billion more years. Another listener, Rob Clementi, emailed me wondering what the point of a clock after the heat death of the universe was and whether anybody would be around to see it. Well, I think the point of the clock was a theoretical exercise. I'm not sure that anyone needs a clock to last the next few quintillion years. Once everything is the same temperature, the universe attains a steady state, with no energy differences. There's no reason for anything to change what it's doing. Heat death is the point at which the universe has finally settled down completely from an energetic standpoint, and nothing interesting ever happens again. Will there be people around to see the clock? Not likely. By the definition of heat death, you cannot have any humans or any other life form alive or any civilization. Civilizations and life forms need energy to live. Without heat sources, there is no energy and no life forms. Basically, the combination of people living and the universe being heat dead is impossible. On the other hand, Rob, remember that we are talking many thousands of trillions of years in the future. If any of our descendants are around at that time, they will not even be remotely human. By that time, they may be sentient time-space crystals themselves, and then they could outlast the heat death of the universe, and maybe even check the time every once in a while on one of those old clocks. Sorry, my odd whimsy gets the better of me sometimes. Let's get on to our official first story of the night. I seem to have two camps of listeners when it comes to exoplanets. One camp thinks that I give too many updates on possible extrasolar planets, and the other group thinks I should actually spend more time giving some of those updates. Well, I sort of call them as I pick them up in the journals. If there are stories about exoplanets, you'll hear about them. And if not, then not.
pretty straightforward there.
Dr. Hugh Jones and his colleagues at the University of Hertfordshire report in the November issue of the journal Astronomy and Astrophysics on a new potentially Earth-like planet that is only 42 light-years away in the constellation Pictor. The star, HD 40307, was thought to harbor only three planets, but Jones's sensitive data filtering methods reveal the presence of three additional planets. The farthest out of these new babies lies in the life zone at a distance from its star where liquid and life, at least theoretically, could exist. Jones says, quote, "It's the position of the planet in its orbit that's important. This planet orbits close enough to its sun-like star so that it could have similar temperatures to Earth. Further, the planet is not putting the same face to its star all the time, like the moon, and it seems to have rotation like the Earth does." Unquote. As anyone who listens regularly to this podcast knows, only a handful of planets have been discovered in the habitable region around their stars. Nothing is as yet known about this new planet's physical and geochemical properties, but Jones says it would make a good target for a space-based imaging mission because it's so close to Earth. That is, as opposed to imaging one of the other possibly habitable super-Earths, like Kepler-22b, which is much farther away than HD 40307, about 620 light-years from Earth. Jones says, quote, "Ultimately, the aim of this research is to constrain the types of solar systems that might support life. The more that stars and solar systems are like our sun and its solar system, the more interesting they are to study." Unquote. The next story. Why look for aliens out there on exoplanets when we can just play Dr. Doolittle and see how the alien species on our own planet think? This next story threw me for a bit of a loop, since I was surprised that it was even possible. But this journal article, and recording, as you'll hear, from the journal Current Biology, make me think of the movie Day of the Dolphin, which, by the way, I recommend to anyone who loves George C. Scott movies or conspiracy thrillers. Or, well, dolphin movies. No, the story from the lab of Dr. Angela Stoger at the University of Vienna is not about talking dolphins, like in Day of the Dolphin. It's about talking elephants, which is something that seems even less likely. Acoustic biologist Stoger was on a trip to Asia, and she discovered a male elephant called Koshik, who was housed in a Korean zoo. Koshik makes sounds close in pitch to human language and reminds Korean speakers of actual words. According to Stoger, this is the first scientifically, systematically studied case of an elephant mimicking human speech, which I do not find too hard to believe. Stoger visited Koshik in South Korea's Everland Zoo. Koshik curls his trunk from the right side and puts the tip into his mouth before making sounds. Because the tip of his trunk covers his mouth, it's just about impossible to see exactly what his trunk tip is doing. But the resulting sounds approximate the pitch of tones in human speech. To see whether the elephant could be understood by the average Korean speaker, Stoger played recordings of Koshik's utterances for 16 Korean speakers, asking them to transcribe the sounds regardless of whether they were actual words or nonsense. Two-thirds of the listeners agreed on the vowels, but said that Koshik's consonants weren't even close to being correct. Half of the listeners copied down Koshik vocalizing "annyeong," which means hello in Korean. Almost half heard "annya," which is Korean for no, which the zoo elephant had probably heard plenty of times. About 15% of the listeners also agreed they heard "nuo," lie down, "anja," sit down, and "choa," which is good. Stoger says, quote, "Koshik can respond appropriately to words, but there's no evidence he uses the sounds with a sense of their meaning. For example, Koshik did not get upset if his keepers didn't sit down when he told them to sit." Unquote. I know you're curious, so here is a recording of Koshik from Stoger's website. The elephant is saying "choa," which is good in Korean. You can then hear the clearly human trainer speaking after him saying "choa annyeong," which is good hello.
Whoa.
Since I don't speak Korean, it sounds pretty good to me, but then I could be wrong. According to Stoger, there have been other animals which have been studied who also have mimicked human speech. There was an orphan harbor seal in Boston named Hoover, who was hand-raised in a bathtub before being moved to an aquarium, and also a white whale called Nock, whose occasional speech-like sounds confuse the heck out of human divers in his tank. I suspect if any of these animals was doing anything more than mimicking, they would probably be asking for immediate release. Next story. For those of you who have been fans of this podcast since the very beginning, and I do mean both Starship Sofa and the Science News, you may remember one of the first stories that I told from several years back, which I discussed having to do with memory erasure. It came up in conjunction with a discussion of some of Tony Smith's fears and bad memories. As longtime listeners know, since the very beginning, Tony has never been averse to talking about himself. At any rate, there was some research years ago that suggested that someday there would be drug treatments available that could erase bad memories and reduce fears in doing so. And I've mentioned progress along those lines over the last few years. Well, those drug treatments promised so many years ago are much closer than they've ever been. At the Society for Neuroscience meeting in New Orleans on October 17th, it was reported by neuroscientist Dr. Asia Rolls of Stanford University that she and her team have a treatment to help forget bad memories. After a drug treatment, fearful associations can be knocked back, quote-unquote, during sleep. Now, this research has been done in mice. Rolls taught her mice that when they smelled jasmine, an electric shock would follow. A day later, as the mice slept, the researchers wafted the smell over the animals, strengthening and solidifying the scary link between jasmine and pain. A day after that, the mice froze in fear when they caught a whiff of jasmine, even though the animals were in an entirely new room unassociated with the original shock. But Rolls could interrupt this sleep-strengthening process with an antibiotic. She injected anisomycin into the amygdala, which is a brain structure involved in memory storage. Before the mice were exposed to jasmine during sleep, the researchers injected their brains with some of this antibiotic. The next day, these mice didn't freeze as much as the mice who didn't get the drug. The results suggest that during sleep, traumatic memories, such as the kind that plague people with post-traumatic stress disorder, can be effectively weakened. As an explanation, Rolls suggested that during sleep, the mind is not rooted in any particular environment, so the effect of curbing traumatic memories in someone who is fast asleep wouldn't be linked to any specific setting, such as a doctor's office. She says, quote, "This could protect a person from re-experiencing the trauma in other situations. What's more, because sleep is a brain state outside of conscious control, it may offer access to memories that are locked up tight during waking hours. And reactivating traumatic memories during sleep may be less painful for people, sparing them the difficulty of reliving a traumatic experience while awake." Unquote. This exact method may not work very well for humans, though. Rolls says, quote, "The drug used in the study was chosen because it targets protein production in cells, a process that strengthens memory during sleep. But the drug does have side effects, and it wouldn't be reasonable to inject it into humans' brains. Still, there might be other safe ways to destroy harmful memories during sleep in people. I think this has huge potential," unquote. And I really must agree with her. Next story. You may think that scientists are a staid lot who go to very boring scientific conferences, and for the most part, you would probably be right if you compared us to conventions of, say, plumbers or dock workers. But this next story was passed along to me by a friend who went to the annual meeting last month of the American Society of Human Genetics. And it suggests that scientists are not quite as boring as one might think. Well, not quite as boring. At the conference, dozens of researchers played something called buzzword bingo during scientific presentations. The game was played on randomly generated bingo cards from the conference website. To play, the attendees listened for speakers to spout certain overused words or phrases or flash slides bearing off-scene images, and then tap the corresponding box on the bingo card. Some of the phrases are ones audiences could hear at any symposium. such as asking if the laser pointer is working or the classic, how am I doing for time? Both of which I think I have said myself. Others are things that you'd only hear at a genetics conference and which you'd pretty much hear nowhere else, like metagenomics or exome chip or $1,000 genome and missing heritability. Heck, you've probably heard me spout some of those. Other weirder references were things like mentions of a little boy from Wisconsin named Nicholas Volker, whose doctors used his DNA sequence as part of his care, or famous scientists like NIH Director Francis Collins, or the father of the personal genetics movement, George Church. Those could also earn players a square if they were on a bingo card. No one shouted bingo in the middle of talks, from what I heard. That would be rude. Even scientists know that. I am told that the perfect way to win would have been to ask a question of the speaker and incorporate bingo into the question, which I guess actually happened a couple of times. I was told that most players who got bingo submitted their scorecards online, and the winners were announced on Twitter. See, scientists are interesting, sad, kind of pathetic, but interesting. How many times have you heard this statement in a really bad movie? Don't move, Bob, and calm yourself down. That predator can smell your fear. Can animals smell fear? It appears the answer is yes, but it really depends on the animal. This new paper by Dr. Mark Weisberg from Georgia Tech in the journal Experimental Biology suggests that crabs can indeed smell fear. Weisberg studied blue crabs. Blue crabs tend to avoid injured crabs and give them a wide berth when they produce an odor when they're injured. They treat it as a warning that a larger predator may be lurking nearby. In short, if a crab smells the fear scent of another crab, it goes in the other direction, probably for fear that it may become lunch instead if it stays in the neighborhood. To study the phenomenon more closely, Weisberg collected crabs from the ocean off Georgia and returned them to the lab where he started to test their reactions to plumes of different odors in a flow tank. Surely enough, when the animals were downstream of luscious, shrimpy smells, they practically ran toward the origin. However, when the water smelled of injured crabs, the animals became evasive and some even buried themselves to avoid the stench. Weisberg then tested how they would react when the two odors were actually flowing in parallel, side by side in close proximity. This time, the crabs were much more cautious. Discriminating between the plumes and following the attractive odor to its source, the crabs were able to successfully home in on the food despite the close proximity of the warning signal. Although they continued to pursue the attractive scent, the crabs actively avoided the side of the tunnel that smelled of injured crab. If the odors were mixed in turbulent water, the crab's perception of the tasty prawn aroma was diluted sufficiently for it to no longer find the smell attractive. Weisberg decided to find out which of their many olfactory organs the crabs used to distinguish between the attractive and aversive odors. He found that the odors were detected by the antennules, and these are small structures between the eyes on the head of the crab. The next story has to do with the so-called 1,000 genome study that was undertaken a couple of years ago. This genome study was an attempt to sequence 1,000 different people and then look for genetic variants that might lead to a better understanding of the complex traits like height or diseases. And it turns out that the study ended up with more than 1,000 genomes. They actually got over 6,000. It was reported at the American Society of Human Genetics conference in Houston that researchers found 1 million variants in the exomes of more than 6,700 individuals. But most, it turns out, have little effect on complex traits, which was a bit of a letdown. Although roughly 720,000 of these variants affected the resulting protein sequences, the team could only link a few of these variants to any disease pathways. For example, the researchers found an association between a variant in the APOC3 gene, which reduced triglyceride levels, fat levels, in the blood. Subjects were recruited from existing NIH studies, including the Jackson Heart Study, the Atherosclerosis Risk in Community Study, and the Women's Health Initiative Project. The team selected subjects based on disease phenotypes that they were interested in, like high or low lipid levels, extreme blood pressures, or early onset heart attacks. In all, the researchers analyzed more than 80 heart, lung, and blood phenotypes. Unlike other genomic studies, this one only looked at protein coding regions of the genome and not at any of the regulatory regions. Most of the variations were found in specific populations. For example, there were gene variants associated with varying white blood cell counts in African Americans, while there were variants in the F7 gene that appeared to influence levels of factor 7, which is an important protein needed in the coagulation of blood cascade, and that was found in European Americans. The new study also confirmed some previously known associations, such as high levels of low-density lipoprotein, that is so-called bad cholesterol, that track with certain variants of the ApoB gene, and associations between the LEPR gene variants and levels of C-reactive protein that seem to increase the body's response to inflammation and have been suggested to have something to do with likelihood of people getting cancer. After the study, it was concluded that the effect of rare genetic variants aren't as great as many scientists predicted, so they will need quite a larger sample size in order to detect any associations. In fact, they are now setting up to look at tens of thousands of people using DNA chip analysis technology, which was actually developed during the first study. The last story of the night has to do with radiation. Before World War II, it was in vogue, for some reason I can't really quite imagine, to consider that radioactivity was healthful. The Home Products Company of Denver, Colorado, advertised in the 1930s for a radioactive suppository for men that would cure impotence. Seems to me that putting anything radioactive in there was not a good idea, but men thought differently back then. It was discovered that healthful mineral springs had detectable levels of radiation, so it was assumed 70 or 80 years ago that radiation must be good for you. There was an onslaught of radioactive consumer products after that, and people by the thousands lined up to buy them. Like the patent medicines that preceded them, most of these products were not developed by doctors or clinically tested, but were instead designed by business people to take advantage of the craze. To make water more healthful, it was stored in radioactive coolers. And sadly, not many people, including doctors, associated drinking water from a uranium-lined water cooler for 5 years with the leukemia that developed 15 years later. Something called radion tablets were popular in the 1920s, and they were just what they sounded like, radium tablets. And they were advertised to give you energy. Ew, I'm sure they did give you energy. Probably not the kind you wanted, though. The 1930s brought radium bread, radium face cream for that healthful glow, and even special radium-filled devices for sale that you could place over your testicles overnight to make you more manly. Ugh. Okay, where am I going with this demented little history lesson? Well, weird as it sounds, Dr. Randy Yertle of the University of Wisconsin reported November 1st in the FASEB Journal that he has found some health benefits to radiation at low levels in mice. He says that radiation acts differently at low doses and produces health benefits for mice who have an unusual genetic makeup. Yertle studied mice known as viable yellow agoutis. These mice are regularly employed to gauge how diet, chemicals, and other environmental conditions affect gene activity in animals, including humans. Agouti mice have a genetic quirk that causes the agouti coat color gene to be turned on in all their body tissues. They have yellow coats, they are yellow mice, they are obese, and they're much more likely to get diabetes and cancer than normal mice. If you attach chemical tags to the DNA in a process called DNA methylation around the agouti gene, it shuts the gene's activity down, leading to lean, brown, healthy mice. Chemical stress or other factors that interfere with that methylation process shift the coat color and health status of the mice, either in one direction where they're unhealthy or in the other direction to make them more healthy. Yertle irradiated pregnant mice at a level of 0.4 centigrays and 7.6 centigrays. Just to put the level of radiation in perspective, a human dental x-ray gives you about 0.4 to 0.8 centigrays. Mother mice that got irradiated had more pups with browner coats than the control mice did. Brown coat color among mice exposed to low-dose radiation was associated with higher levels of DNA methylation on the agouti gene. That is, turning off the agouti gene. In other words, it looks like the DNA methylation of the agouti gene was increased somehow, indicating that radiation does something to alter that chemical tagging. And in this case, turning off the agouti gene that made the mice fat and diabetes prone. Here is the kicker, and it's even weirder. Yertl found out that in this case, giving the pregnant mice antioxidant vitamins actually made the offspring sicker. It seems that the antioxidants blocked the process of methylation tagging that turned off the agouti gene. Yertl suggests that radiation is creating oxidants, chemicals that are hungry to interact with other molecules. Too many oxidants in a cell can literally tear proteins, DNA, and other chemical components apart. But small numbers of oxidants serve as chemical messengers in cells. Apparently, in this case, low-level radiation may have signaled cells to shut down the agouti activity, thus making the mice healthier. But, and it is a big but, vitamins and other antioxidants that intercept those messages would promote the unhealthy state in the offspring. As you can imagine, Yertl wasn't exactly thrilled with this result. Quote, "Nobody wants to think that low-dose radiation could be advantageous. And worse, the stuff that you put in your vitamin pill would be bad for you," unquote. It's completely unclear whether any of this has anything to do with humans, and whether low doses of radiation can help people in any way, shape, or form. But back in the 1930s, before antibiotics became widespread, some doctors actually successfully treated ear and sinus infections and gangrene with low doses of x-rays. So there is at least some history of the idea, but somehow I suspect a lot more evidence is going to be needed before anybody around today lets a doctor irradiate him like their David Bruce Banner or something. Well, that's all from me for now. As always, take care. In the unlikely event, the end of the world comes before my next podcast in December. Thanks for listening, and I hope I have inspired some of you. Until next time, maybe, this is Jim Campanella.